A recent report by the CDC on the efficacy of vaccine administration in the US for COVID identifies a few numbers that underlie some of the conflict relating to the vaccination program. The major contention among the sides, though I hate to put it that way, in this topic is that, from one point of view, the virus itself and its variants are so deadly that any vaccination program, even one which is somewhat error-prone, is still beneficial, and our only chance of returning to a normal life is to administer a program of vaccination as quickly as possible. And from the other point of view, a virus with a relatively high survivability rate, which has already permeated through a large percentage of the population, should not be countered by a vaccine which also causes death and other health issues when so little is yet known about it. This is, of course, leaving to the side any issues related to the more uncertain or at least unverifiable theories. But what the numbers in the CDC paper show, and while some will point out the inconsistency of the CDC's own guidance and wonder about its integrity, it generally has been seen that the reports and outcomes of individual papers remain above such political squabbling, and therefore I think it is still relevant to take the papers from the CDC as relevant news, if indeed we are to take anything seriously. And what it shows is that between mid-December and mid-January 2020 to 2021, just under 14 million vaccine doses were administered in the United States. Of that, there were just about 7,000 adverse events, incidents that occurred that seemed to be related to the vaccination. Most of those were classified as non-serious. The remaining number of incidents was 640. Now, this is a small, almost vanishingly small percentage, but of course, if you are a friend or family member of the approximately 115 deaths as an outcome of vaccine as of the time of the writing of this paper, it's of small comfort that the likelihood of a fatal outcome of the vaccine is small. When we compare so far the rate of death of exposure to the virus in a viral load significant enough to not be asymptomatic against the outcome of vaccination, the fatality rate of virus exposure is indeed small, but the fatal outcome rate of vaccination is, in fact, smaller. Of course, this doesn't necessarily justify substituting the one for the other, especially as we're relatively early on in the vaccination process. It's especially relevant that the vaccination remains effectively voluntary for the time being. The important thing to note is that, to some degree, exposure to the virus and administration of the vaccine are both choices that an individual can make. It may be difficult for an individual to remain in their home 100% of the time, or at least away from other people 100% of the time, but with the adjustments that society has made, it is relatively straightforward for most individuals, especially those with higher risk factors, to avoid, to a very large likelihood, a chance of exposure. But for an extended period of time, this becomes impractical, eventually untenable. But for an individual who must consider their mortality when examining their likelihood of being exposed to the virus and that of letting themselves receive the vaccination, it effectively comes down to a choice between two potential evils. One known with a somewhat higher rate of danger, and one less known with, so far, a somewhat smaller rate of danger. Benjamin Franklin wrote about the dangers and benefits of inoculations at a time when, prior to modern vaccination, the danger of receiving the inoculation against a virus was very high. He himself had lost a son to smallpox, and he wrote that administering an inoculation to your child and the danger with it is a very difficult decision for a parent to make. The danger posed by smallpox was so significant that failing to act and failing to take that chance of administering the inoculation and the danger that goes with it is effectively dereliction of duty as a parent. To paraphrase his specific words, he said, "I regretted bitterly that I had not, given the inoculation to him. This I mention for the sake of parents who omit that operation on the supposition that they should never forgive themselves if a child died under it. My example showing that their regret may be the same either way, and that therefore the safer should be chosen. That is to say, given two dangers, taking the one of lower risk with an action that can be taken to provide some measure of safety would seem morally and practically to be the superior. But of course, the question also tangents onto motive. When, for the sake of popular health, debate about the vaccine is to a degree stymied, at least in the political sphere, and to some degree in journalism. This problem is exacerbated by the fact that there are concerns along a spectrum which vary from the eminently practical to wild conspiracies. This is all the more so difficult to respond to because not all the facts are present. And while we can sanely relegate some notions to the corner of being highly unlikely, history suggests that we cannot be too quick to denounce all things which seem from our viewpoint unlikely simply because we think they're unlikely. Stranger things have happened. Of course, nor does that mean that you must accept them as likely, but it does mean that they are topics worthy of debate. And where there is an absence of facts available and an absence of debate, we arrive at a very difficult crossroads. We're trying to vaccinate a population against a deadly virus with a potentially deadly vaccination process, about which the facts about either one are not yet fully known, may not be for some time. If we encourage debate with lack of facts, there is the danger of misinformation running rampant. Certainly there is some of that, but the claims that are made of misinformation do not always pertain to the misinformation. Regarding this, see some of the censorship, as it were, though not by government fiat, on various social media platforms regarding these debates. Sometimes it is very wild conspiracy theories that are removed. Other times it is actual debate and concern over the facts present. But it's all jumbled together in one bag. One confusing bag of facts and theories and concerns and unknowns. And the numbers are only first beginning to come out, and it may be a long time before we have the whole truth, and yet we must make decisions based on that incomplete information. At an individual level, for receiving the vaccine, for living our lives, for how to respond to the danger of the virus, and at a societal level, for how much leverage to place on any one course of action, how to restrict or enforce certain needs and requirements relating to the virus, the vaccination, and so forth. All we can really say is that the lines of communication must remain open. We should strive to keep debate within the framework of sanity, but at the same time, admit that we don't know everything and that reality can be stranger than fiction. We don't have to accept any given reality in order to make a practical decision for the present, which can simply be based on our best understanding of the facts as it stands. And when we get to the point of making a decision, possibly one of many, we must recognize that there is no guarantee of making the right decision, and we must be capable as individuals of accepting the fallout. To quote, "It is possible to commit no mistakes and still lose. That is not a weakness, that is life." We're in a very uncertain arena here, and we must make decisions, and those decisions should be based as much on fact as it is possible to achieve. But we must also recognize that outcomes will transpire regardless of the actions we take. As long as we maintain open dialogue and open minds, we have a chance, culturally, societally, of having an overwhelmingly positive outcome. But to get there, we must ensure that dialogue, that analysis, the thinking, don't stop.